add Kavanaugh to the Democratic impeachment wish list, and add Lewandowski to the list of snarling, uncooperative witnesses. And add us to the list of those mourning the death of the irreplaceable Cokie Roberts. All this week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Joe Biden keeps making gaffes and remains unsteady in the debates. And yet, he's still the clear Democratic frontrunner.
So there is a reservoir of goodwill for him that I think some campaigns underestimated. There is enough of that that he can make mistakes and it doesn't really drag him down. But there are openings.
Plus, how can we forget this?
These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other or we must die.
We'll look back on the most notorious political attack ad of all time. And we remember the life of the beloved and respected journalist Cokie Roberts by replaying an interview we conducted with her 6 years ago.
I'm missing my mother a lot. She worked with people on both sides of the aisle. She would find a common cause with people, and she would make their lives easier by finding ways to work with them on things that they needed as she was asking them to do things that she needed.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 295 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Well, he's back. Brett Kavanaugh, as you well remember, was confirmed by the Senate to serve on the Supreme Court last October after a very contentious Judiciary Committee hearing in which he was accused of sexual assault. Now he's returned to the front pages after a new book by two New York Times reporters state that the FBI ignored additional allegations made against him during last year's inquiry. The book states that Senator Chris Coons, a Delaware Democrat, wrote to FBI Director Christopher Wray with what Coons called information relevant to the investigation, but that Wray, who may have been on a short leash from the White House, failed to act or even respond. Democrats immediately pounced on that, with several of them calling not only for a reopening of the investigation, but for Kavanaugh's impeachment as well. That list includes at least six of the party's presidential candidates. Republicans see it differently. Here was Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor.
For anybody who's been reading the news the past few days, it's probably felt a little like Groundhog Day. Because over the last couple of days, leading Democrats have tried to grab onto yet another poorly sourced, thinly reported, unsubstantiated allegation against Justice Brett Kavanaugh. There they go again.
Of course, nobody thinks an impeachment process is going to go anywhere, given the fact that the Democrats have their hands full and remain split over how to handle their case against President Trump. House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler said as much on WNYC Radio.
Frankly, we are concentrating our resources on determining whether to impeach the president. Personally, I think the president ought to be impeached, but we have to concentrate on that for the next few months.
And for all the calls for impeaching Supreme Court justices in our history, how can we forget the John Birch Society's Impeach Earl Warren billboards in the 1950s and 60s? Or Congressman Gerry Ford's hopes of impeaching William O. Douglas in 1970, only one has ever actually been impeached, Samuel Chase, 215 years ago. Impeached by the House in 1804, Chase was acquitted by the Senate. Later in this program, we're going to talk about the passing of Cokie Roberts, one of our favorite people in the world. We're going to replay an interview we did with her following the death of her mother, former Congresswoman Lindy Boggs, 6 years ago. But the journalism world lost another giant this week as well. Sandy Van Oker, the great reporter who starred at NBC News and later ABC News, died at the age of 91. He covered presidents and he covered presidential nominating conventions. He was the last surviving journalist who participated in the first Kennedy-Nixon debate in 1960, back when he was still at NBC. In 1984, by then at ABC, he moderated the vice presidential debate between George Bush and Geraldine Ferraro. He was also a panelist at one of the debates among Bush, Bill Clinton, and Ross Perot in 1992. In that 1960 debate, he asked Richard Nixon a question that clearly made the vice president uncomfortable.
Mr. Vice President, since the question of executive leadership is a very important campaign issue, I'd like to follow Mr. Novin's question. Now, Republican campaign slogans, you see them on signs around the country, as we did last week, say, it's experience that counts. That's over a picture of yourself, sir. Implying that you've had more governmental executive decision-making experience than your opponent. Now, in his news conference on August 24th, President Eisenhower was asked to give one example of a major idea of yours that he adopted. His reply was, and I'm quoting, "If you give me a week, I might think of one. I don't remember." Now, that was a month ago, sir, and the president hasn't brought it up since. And I'm wondering, sir, if you can clarify which version is correct, the one put out by Republican campaign leaders or the one put out by President Eisenhower?
Well, I would suggest, Mr. Van Oker, that if you know the president, that was probably a facetious remark. I would also suggest that insofar as his statement is concerned, that I think it would be improper for the President of the United States to disclose the instances in which members of his official family had made recommendations, as I have made them through the years, to him, which he has accepted or rejected.
But Nixon knew the question was damaging. As he wrote in his 1962 book, Six Crises, quote, "I am sure that to millions of televiewers, this question had been effective in raising a doubt in their minds with regard to one of my strongest campaign themes and assets, my experience as vice president." That blast from the past leads to this week's trivia question. In the history of televised presidential debates, who was the first woman to be the debate moderator? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Why do we never get an answer when we're knocking at the door? With a thousand million questions about hate and death and war. Because when we stop and look around us, there is nothing that we need. In a world of persecution that is burning in its greed.
We've now had three Democratic presidential debates, and while he has taken everything his rivals have thrown at him, Joe Biden still leads the pack. The frontrunner, as everyone likes to say, despite his gaffes, his embellishing of stories, his garbling of the English language. There's fewer than 5 months to go before the voters have their say, starting off with Iowa and New Hampshire, plenty of time for things to change. And there's no shortage of candidates who are trying to shake up the existing status quo. Dave Weigel of the Washington Post is here with a tally sheet. Dave, it's great to have you back on the Political Junkie.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, with all the criticism leveled at Joe Biden, his syntax, his age, his being risk-averse, he's still leading in every poll I've seen. Now, we have another debate coming up on October 15th, but have you seen anything that jeopardizes his position?
Well, I've seen his campaign, which is, I think, the biggest impediment to his position. It sounds a little bit silly when they argue that someone's greatest enemy is their own candidacy, their own talent. But if you spend time with Biden on the road, you do notice he's got some sharp days and she's got some kind of rambly speeches that don't get people going. If you look at his support, it often trails by about 10 points the number of people who think that he is the most electable candidate. So there is a reservoir of goodwill for him that I think some campaigns underestimated. There is enough of that that he can make mistakes and it doesn't really drag him down the way that other campaigns, again, hoped it would or anticipated. But there are openings. I mean, we've been through this before. He's doing a little bit worse than Hillary Clinton was against Barack Obama in 2008, much worse than she did against Bernie Sanders. So you see why other candidates imagine an opening for themselves.
But we talk about the goodwill that people have for him. And, of course, African-Americans support him mostly for his 8 years as the loyal vice president under Barack Obama. But when you watch these debates and you see him, well, I don't want to quote Julian Castro, but somewhat seemingly confused, or at least some of his answers are confusing. And yet when all is said and done, the debates are over, the numbers don't seem to change at all.
They have been changing in very subtle ways. And this is, if you're a Biden campaign staffer, frankly, they've been pretty disciplined and not complaining about the way the media is always looking for a reason that he could fall. But what I've been noticing is the proportion of people who say they're comfortable with a candidate, who say they're excited with a candidate, who say they view somebody favorably. And when this process started, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders had an enormous lead in favorability among Democrats and who they were comfortable with a big caveat that both were seen by about a third of Democratic voters is too old to be president. Over the last 6 months, Warren has really chipped away, and no one has come close in building on her favorability, building on the number of people who consider her a strong second choice. So when it comes to just the polling of these first two states, because this is a way to get out of the thicket on non-white voters, in Iowa and New Hampshire, which are largely white electorates, largely liberal Democratic electorates with some independents coming in. In those places, she's become very popular even if she's not in the lead, and Biden has taken a little bit of damage.
Unlike Elizabeth Warren, there are other candidates who seem like the best way to get attention is by attacking Joe Biden. We saw it in the first debate. We certainly saw it in the last debate. In the first one, Kamala Harris went after him on busing and his Southern segregationist pals. And while she got an immediate bump in the polls and money, it didn't last long, right? And then it was also Eric Swalwell talked about the passing of the torch, and nobody heard from him again. But I think what I'm trying to do is try to lead to what happened the last debate with Julian Castro, who seemingly attacked Biden for his failure to remember what he said, which to many people sounds like an attack on his age.
They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
Would not have to buy in. If she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago? I mean, I can't believe that you said 2 minutes ago that they had to buy in, and now you're saying they don't have to buy. You're forgetting that.
I said anyone. I mean, look.
Yeah. So since that happened, and that was about a week ago, Julian Castro's favorable ratings have decreased a little bit. Biden's have also decreased a little bit. But Castro's starting lower and has gotten lower since making that comment. There is very little interest from Democratic voters in hearing people go negative. What I've heard occasionally is high propensity voting Democrats, and this is a problem really for Sanders, resent how long the primary went last time, resent the negativity. They had generally pretty good primaries in most of their states where things didn't get too vicious. And they are not in the mood to reward people if it looks like they are trying to drag someone else down. And this has been a real difficulty because one reason some people are running is there are Democrats who sincerely believe that despite the polling, Joe Biden's lost a lot of his political skill and would be a bad nominee, and that they are in a better position to beat Donald Trump. I think the reason not every single Democrat has endorsed Biden is because there's agreement on that. But what no one has ascertained is how to make that argument without coming off churlish and hurting yourself. No one has done that yet. Literally nobody has figured that out.
And I'm just wondering if these debates have changed much. I know the only difference with the next debate coming October 15th is that Tom Steyer has been added to the list. So that means there's two nights of the debate. Is that correct? So do you have any idea how the division of candidates is going to be done? Is it 6 and 5? Is it front runners?
So the DNC, a lot of what it's done in regard to debates is about preventing the attacks of last cycle, preventing being accused of putting a finger on the scale for other people. They're pretty satisfied with that. Honestly, because so much of that anger at perceived unfairness came from supporters of Bernie Sanders, because Sanders is sliding in easily to each debate. You just do not hear a lot of opposition to these rules. I mean, you hear Michael Bennett complain, and Michael Bennett's family probably agrees with him, but not a lot of Democrats do.
And Steve Bullock as well.
And Steve Bullock, you do hear complain. So the way that is going to play out in October is that, once again, the DNC is kind of letting CNN decide how to cut the stage up. Or if you remember, this might be one of those memories that you'd banish from your mind and now it's coming back and you're going to resent me for it. CNN had a 30-minute TV special, maybe a 60-minute TV special, where, you know, commercial break by commercial break, they revealed who was going to be on the debate stage. Remember this now? And so they could do that again. I think it got okay ratings, even if everyone said they hated it. And in that setting, if there are more than 10 candidates, they haven't announced this yet, it is expected they would split into two camps. And the way they did this before was some kind of waiting so that the people with, you know, double-digit support were not all on the same stage at once. That is controversial among some Democrats. They really think it'll be October. People are starting to tune in. The utility of trapping like a Elizabeth Warren on a different stage than Joe Biden at this point, I think there's going to be anger at that. And if it was Bernie Sanders who's kept on a different stage than those two, people would be angry at that. I don't think there's a way they could split it to make people happy, because they've sworn they're not going to do it either completely randomly, or that they will not have an undercard debate the way Republicans did last time. You're not going to get one with six candidates polling at 2% and six candidates polling at 10 or above.
Right. I already missed George Pataki, right?
Yes, he did run for president. Kind of forget that from time to time.
But what about all those candidates who will be missing out for two debates in a row, the John Delaney's, the Bill de Blasio, the Tim Ryan's, the Joe Sestak's? Are they long for this campaign? I mean, it's hard to raise money if voters aren't talking about them.
You're an observer of all these things as I am, so it's kind of fun to split people into categories. May not be fun for the people involved, but for us in trying to make sense of this, there are candidates who have big ambitions but not a ton of money or organization and are looking for a breakthrough. And then there are candidates who have been hanging out looking for free media attention, kind of enjoying this process, enjoying the state fair, and are not really going to build anything at all. So on the second camp, you've got Bill de Blasio, you've got the Florida mayor, Wayne Messam, who at this point is not really a real candidate. He's not campaigned in 2 months. But they're not taking their names off of the FEC forms. They say they're still running for president. You have some other people like Sestak who are really doing the work. I mean, he's holding five or six events a day in Iowa. I've been to some. It has the feeling of a lark. I mean, people are being very polite, spending some time with this candidate, and they're not coming out saying they've switched their support from Joe Biden to him. He is unlikely to make any debates, but you know, these people are invited to party meetings. What I've detected, and really I've detected for months, is that the Democrats who get into these meetings, if they had seven candidates, they might each get 15 minutes to talk and get a good sense of what they're thinking. When they've got close to 20, these are marathon events where sometimes they don't hear anything new and the speeches leave their head. There's been real irritation by grassroots Democrats at how crowded this field is. So some of them have already done the compartmentalizing. I mean, I've seen evidence that people dropped corn in a jar at the Iowa State Fair saying they supported, you know, Seth Moulton. But Moulton was pretty realistic about the fact that no one was coming out. A couple friends of his who endorsed him, no one else was interested in getting the organization in place to elect him. And they're of the people who are actually assembling the machinery that could win the Iowa caucuses if they continue doing well, or if they have a breakthrough. You really think you're down to Warren and Sanders and Biden. You've got Klobuchar, you've got Booker, you've got Harris, you've got Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke. And after that, it gets a little bit dicey.
Well, let me talk about, you mentioned Harris, and I kind of thought that she was going to be in a better position than she is today. I think certainly in the beginning she was in good shape, but and in the debate last week, she was the only Democrat on stage who regularly went after Trump instead of her fellow Democrats, and I think that has to account for something. But sometimes, I don't know, maybe too often, she either sidesteps or avoids questions.
Yeah, a few things have happened to her that all fit under the rubric of I think a few things have happened to her that I think fit under the rubric of a candidate being very good on paper and not always performing to that level. So she had an extremely good launch, and she had a very good first debate. But under pressure, when she's been asked to clarify some of her litmus test stances on health care and other issues, she has been confusing. And the problem with being a little bit confusing in this field is that people have choices that are not confusing. They've got the very clear positions of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren if they're on the left, and they've got somebody familiar in Joe Biden, and if you confuse them, they can easily migrate away. I also think just as a performer, in the pure sense of theater and working on television, Harris impressed people in the first debate. It was easy to imagine her on stage with Donald Trump and him wilting it in front of her. And she did not impress people in the second, and she did not change people's minds in the third. So she's been the candidate most affected by these debates, the theatrical nature of them, the simulation of what it is like to be in the media hothouse for a couple hours on TV. That has benefited a couple people, but it's really hurt her. And it hurt her in part because she did so well the first time. I mean, if you're a scout and you see a pitcher who has one no-hitter and then the next three games he blows it, I don't think you're going to recruit him.
I watched her the first debate, and she seemed very natural. I mean, maybe, you know, I was that girl. Maybe a lot of it was prepared responses, but she seemed very natural. And I think the last one, she seemed to look for jokes that she thought was very funny and nobody else thought was funny. And I just wonder if she's either trying too hard or she's losing. She's forgetting what advantage she does have, because I think she's a very strong and good candidate and effective candidate when she's Kamala Harris, but not when she's somebody else.
I think that's an interesting analysis. She has a stump speech that does a little bit to introduce her, but can get a little bit windy, and it isn't quite clear where her positions are. She has framed everything in her agenda as the 3 a.m. Plan. She wants to focus only on the issues that keep you awake at night at 3 a.m., which is a strange framing because everyone has that. I mean, whatever you think of Joe Biden, if you think he's too centrist, I mean, he has a health care plan. He has some student debt ideas. He has a climate plan. He has dealt with the things the Democrats say they're most worried about. Everyone has. So she has not come out with something crisp, and that's dangerous when, if you're looking for, you know, not Joe Biden, not Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren exists, she is so clear, and there's very little worry that you throw her a question, she's gonna dissemble, or she's gonna say something she didn't mean to say. I mean, the last time I can think of her doing that was honestly when she just kept getting pressed by CNN if the DNC had rigged the process in 2016. That was 2 years ago that she said something that people decided was a gaffe. So I think that's been the problem with Harris. I mean, there are a lot of Democrats that you meet in Iowa, New Hampshire, I think especially Iowa, although I'm not sure why more there, who remember, and they've really inflated in their mind, the second debate between Clinton and Trump, the town hall debate, where Trump was on the ropes and was just, you know, physically pretty aggressive in invading Clinton's space and trying to bring back all of Bill Clinton's scandals, trying to tie them to Hillary Clinton. So one thing I've heard specifically is that people want to imagine that candidate not being loomed over, being, you know, bullied by Donald Trump. And Warren, I think, has filled that role recently more than Harris has, after some doubt in the beginning. I mean, the big doubt about Warren for a lot of attentive activist Democrats was if Trump teased her into taking a DNA test, what would he not be able to bait her on? And that's really the last time he baited her on anything, and that was 9 months ago.
And I kind of think that everything that she's done, Elizabeth Warren has done since then, has been mostly positive, or at least received in a positive way. I mean, I kind of think that the positive, you know, when Pete Buttigieg was the flavor of the month early in the campaign, that role seems to have been taken not only by Elizabeth Warren, but also by Beto O'Rourke. I mean, tragically, in the aftermath of El Paso, he seems to have come onto his own. He's more impressive than he's ever been. But Elizabeth Warren, she never makes a mistake. She, unlike Bernie Sanders, she smiles a lot, which he still hasn't learned how to do. But even if she won't give a direct answer about how much will this cost or what taxes might go up, she is very clear. She makes good points. And it just seems like she has impressed me much more than I expected for somebody whose platform I'm not convinced will be saleable.
Yeah, and I think a question some Democrats have about her, and when it leaks into reporting, it's been enraging to Sanders supporters, is that she is a much more successful, skilled operator within party politics than Sanders is. She's somebody who you can imagine, you know, not abandoning and flip-flopping ideas, but changing the emphasis. Whereas Sanders is going to go, you know, guns a-blazing on healthcare, and he's talked about it the same way for 30 years. She is an effective communicator and can change course when something she realized she stumbled across something more effective. I mean, even the way in the last few interviews she's done, well, people press her on whether you'd have to raise taxes to pay for Medicare for All. She has a adroit non-answer, which is, you and I both know, important in running for president to be able to not answer things.
She's also, unlike Bernie Sanders, she's a Democrat.
That too. And there's a few things people have been watching. Honestly, I was watching them in the first debate and ended up a little bit surprised at how little people brought attacks of Warren into the forefront. I mean, I think this is three debates now where no one's decided it was in their interest. No one in the top tier has decided it was in their interest to really go after her. So in that debate, I was expecting some attacks on her beyond the policy. I mean, policy is honestly not a strong place for Biden to go after people because he just has less command of the details. He's never been a details guy. He's been the guy who brings everybody into the room and gets their confidence and cuts a compromise. He's never been a big idea candidate. I mean, honestly, in 2008, everyone forgets this, but he was a replace the campaign finance system with public finance candidate. He dropped that because now he's raising money. So I thought that there'd be some attacks on Warren over her legal career, and I thought that there might be a jab at her for having only become a Democrat in the 1990s. No one really did that. Probably a good move for Bernie Sanders that he didn't, because for the reason that she is a Democrat, has given millions of dollars to the party, has worked very well with his leadership, and he hasn't. For Sanders fans, I think that's one of his greatest selling points. For other Democrats, look, I mean, they're a member of a party for a reason. They've defended it, as a lot of people have, you know, bolted or become independent or try to sabotage it. And it's an advantage, I think, that has been underrated until you look at the movement around Sanders.
The only person I would say is attacking the Sanders-Warren way of looking at things, and it really wasn't an attack, but it was Amy Klobuchar, in the sense that she was just talking about what you know, there are things that are nice and there are things that are realistic, and she seemed to be focusing on what's more realistic and what's more, you know, as I said, saleable. Now, I don't know if, I mean, she doesn't seem to be part of the conversation anymore. Or maybe the fact is because Joe Biden is a centrist, and that's taking up all the room that she would have liked to have filled. But all the arguments she makes against, you know, the Medicare for All and the things that may not be affordable as proposed by Warren, as proposed by Sanders, she seems to be the strongest on that. And yet, I don't know if she's getting any traction on that at all.
I don't think she is. I was with Klobuchar and other Democrats at an AFL-CIO forum yesterday in Philadelphia, and what I heard coming out of there was just people didn't find her very inspiring. I mean, she has a very deadpan, efficient style of speaking, not boring per se, but she tends to bring things back to what she's been able to pass, and she has a sense of humor that's extremely dry, and I think works a lot of the time. But she's not been exciting in a field where there are several exciting options.
Yeah, I was going to say that maybe realism never sells as well as, you know, bold plans, whether they're realistic or not, right?
That might be true.
How strong do you think this Biden lead is? And again, you know, I mean, you think of, you know, in October's of years past, you know, before the debates, before the primaries start, and you could have a front runner, you could have somebody else who could fade very quickly once the voters have their say. So, I mean, I guess the question is, we do have a long way to go before anything is certain.
Yeah, we do. I think it is now increasingly clear that most Democratic voters are pretty satisfied with the choices of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, and honestly, after that, everyone else I hear is in their, I usually hear they're in their top two, their top three, Kamala Harris to some extent. So I am skeptical that somebody not who's not been punching in that top tier right now can break through. I think the nominee is likely to be one of those people. And I think just looking at the primary map and calendar, that's my preferred way to dodge this question is to say we have to look at it after Iowa, or maybe even the first week before Iowa. If Elizabeth Warren does not win Iowa, New Hampshire, I think she'll quit the race. If Bernie Sanders doesn't, I don't think he will. If Joe Biden doesn't win those states, I don't think he will. But doing so would shake things up, and I think Sanders, if he were to win those states, would inspire more of a rallying in the party around some alternative. I think Warren, if she were to defeat Biden in the first two states, would have much more of a division. She would have proven that she is a strong campaigner, and she does not have the same, I think, vulnerabilities with Democrats that Sanders does. There's a lot of love for him in the party, but there are a lot of forces in the party that he can't stop fighting with. And what you saw over the last week, the Working Families Party, which is, as you know, kind of a fusion third party progressive activist group that often endorses Democrats, it endorsed Warren, and 3 days later, allies of Sanders are still attacking them for having done so. So I think the first arrangement in Iowa would determine whether Warren's the nominee. It is harder to see a path for Sanders in a one-on-one thing, which is why you see a lot of his supporters argue that he should stay in the race till the convention and try his luck there. But I think the appetite in the party for a long primary where it would just be Bernie Sanders collecting delegates is pretty minimal.
Although we used to say, I mean, the old expression was there are three tickets out of Iowa and maybe out of New Hampshire too. But when you still have 20, well, you won't have 20 candidates come January or February, but if you still have 10 candidates, maybe more can survive a defeat in Iowa, New Hampshire, and just see they try their luck on March 3rd, Super Tuesday.
Yeah, some of them can't, though. I mean, I think Amy Klobuchar's campaign is over if she doesn't win Iowa. It's impossible for a Minnesota candidate. She's in a position where Tim Pawlenty was in a similar polling position 4 years ago and was already out of the race by this point. Eight years ago, Scott Walker was jumping out of the race at this point because he was from Wisconsin. It's very hard to pretend you're competitive if you're not doing well in Iowa and you border it. She's actually lasted longer than most people who don't have a lot of pull in the first state. So I think some of these people I think there'd be a real culling after Iowa. A lot of people who've bet things on there, and I struggle to see more than five people in the race at the maximum after that.
Dave Weigel is a political reporter with the Washington Post. Dave, thank you as always for your insight.
Thank you.
There's a line in Woody Allen's movie Sleeper where he says, "Sex and death are two things that happen only once in life, except after death you don't feel nauseous." Well, there's something else that happened only once. It was the airing of the controversial 1964 Daisy ad on behalf of President Lyndon Johnson's campaign against Republican opponent Barry Goldwater. It begins with a little girl pulling petals from a flower and counting.
Stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live or to go into the dark. We must either love each other or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
It was considered a brutal ad, suggesting that the election of Goldwater, who opposed the nuclear test ban treaty, could lead to the unimaginable. It aired on September 7th, 1964, 55 years ago this month. The Johnson campaign immediately removed it, never to air it again. But the damage was done. Bob Mann is a professor of media and public affairs at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge and the author of Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds, LBJ, Barry Goldwater, and the Ad That Changed American Politics. I spoke with Bob in 2014 upon the 50th anniversary of the Daisy ad.
It wasn't necessarily the first negative ad, but it was the first ad that literally and figuratively sort of blew up in another candidate's camp and sort of changed the way that politicians looked at how to run against their opponent using emotion and fear and really narrative and parable and telling a story about the other guy.
And actually, when you listen to it, Goldwater's name was never mentioned in the ad.
No, it wasn't. And that was the brilliance of the spot that the Johnson's ad makers, Doyle Dane Birnbach, DDB, really understood something fundamental that a lot of political advertisers or most political advertisers of that era did not know. And that was that the audience didn't need any more information about Barry Goldwater and his position on nuclear war and nuclear weaponry. What it needed was context for the information they already had in abundance. And it gave them a story. And it gave them a shocking story, an arresting story. But it was a story nonetheless that didn't need to mention Goldwater because the audience knew very well who it was talking about.
When you think back to 1964 and you think back what the polls looked like at the time, Johnson really didn't have any need to go negative on Goldwater, did he?
No, he didn't. And it always, in the research for the book, perplexed me. Why did these guys, why did Johnson go negative? This was the first ad of the campaign, and it's, as you know, it's not traditional to go hard negative from the beginning. You usually run bio spots and kind of soften up the voters and make them like you, and then you go negative or have somebody else go negative for you. But they went negative from the very beginning. I think partly it was because they wanted to put Goldwater away. There were some concerns in the Johnson camp that they had waited too long, kind of dithered a little bit and hadn't gone after Goldwater the way they should. Goldwater was sort of making a little bit of a move in August that concerned Johnson's people, but more than anything, I think Johnson wanted to win a landslide of historic proportions. He wanted to beat FDR's percentage, and he did by just a couple of tenths of a point, 3/10 of a point, I believe, to be exact. But he wanted to win a landslide. He just didn't want to win the election. He wanted to crush Goldwater and have a mandate to do what he eventually did in the Way of the Great Society, and that spot and the others that came after it helped him do that.
Well, as dramatic of a commercial as that was, I mean, Goldwater's views about nuclear war and to a lesser extent his famous quote about extremism, well, those were pretty controversial too.
Yeah, they were, and you know, the people that produced that spot and you know, Goldwater himself and others were they sort of regarded it as a really negative spot. Goldwater regarded it as a really nasty spot, and you know, sort of the beginning of dirty politics and all that. But I've always taken the position that Goldwater's own record and his own words, his own reckless words, really damned him. It wasn't the spot that did it. Goldwater had already done it to himself. The spot was just sort of the icing on the cake. Goldwater had said a lot of stuff that he shouldn't have said, and actually reporters at the time didn't fully quote him. They were actually being fairly kind to him. They didn't quote him verbatim on a lot of other crazy stuff he said about nuclear weapons at the time that could have hurt him even more. But Johnson in that spot did a good job of harnessing the fears that people already had about Goldwater because Goldwater's words and his actions were so well known.
Regardless of what it did to the 64 campaign, and it may not have had an effect at all, but it did change the way politics and political advertising were presented.
It did. You know, you look at, I like to always tell people to go to the website, The Living Room Candidate, which is a great repository of the spots from every presidential campaign since 1952, and I say, look at the 1960 race, look at the 1956 race, look at the 1952 race, look at all those spots, and then look at the Johnson spots from 1964, and there's a quantum leap in creativity and quality in approach, using creative advertising principles, using emotion, striking what Tony Schwartz called that responsive chord. And then look at Goldwater spots from 1964, and they are stuck in time. They look like they're 10 years older than they really are. It was really a revolution in political advertising, especially if you look at 1968, only 4 years later, and you see that everybody said, now we get it. Now we understand what we have to do. And there was never any question after 1964 that political advertising was was advertising. It wasn't giving out information. It wasn't condensing your speech. It was really advertising, advertising a product, the candidate and his ideas.
This was a far cry from I Like Ike of 52, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Although, you know, that race in 1952, Rosser Reeves, who did the ads for Eisenhower, that was sort of one little small burst of creativity, but it really wasn't creative in the sense that we eventually saw in 1964 and after. It's interesting to look at the spots from Kennedy in 1960, which kind of emulate some of those Eisenhower ads, kind of cartoonish and using, you know, silly jingles and all that. And the campaigns really did away with that after 1964.
How many people saw the ad when it was first broadcast? And I wonder how many people have seen it since.
Well, the estimates are that about 50 million people saw it that night, on that Monday night. It was shown a little bit before 10 o'clock on the East Coast during Monday Night at the Movies, which was the most popular show at the time. And the movie was David and Bathsheba, and so a lot of people were watching, and they saw it. And then it's probably an equal number of people who either saw it again or saw it for the first time later in the week when all the three television networks did stories on the spot and showed the spot in its entirety. So I think it's probably a safe bet that about 100 million people saw it that week.
If you're in any swing state in the country, and you being in Louisiana, you have a real hot Senate race this year, you can't help but turn on the TV and be bombarded with negative political ads. Do you think we have Daisy to thank for that?
Well, in a sense we do, but in a sense we don't. I mean, Daisy was one of these, you know, sort of moments where there was maybe the only communal experience in political advertising where, you know, sort of everybody in the country saw and experienced this ad because the audience was so, at that time, so unfragmented and unsegmented. I mean, it was actually possible to reach 50 million people and reach them in a way that was memorable, that you didn't have to show the ad again, didn't have to show it ad nauseum, and it was memorable enough that you didn't have to do that. Now, you know, the audience is so segmented, and there are no really communal experiences other than maybe the debates during presidential campaigns anymore. The way that messages are communicated are you know, sliced and diced, targeted to individual, you know, one spot for this group, another spot for that group. This was a spot, you know, that wasn't meant for a narrow demographic. It was, they threw it up there, and knowing that 50 million people would see it, it's hard to imagine something like that happening again today.
Bob Mann is a professor of communications at LSU. For years before that, he was a press secretary for Democratic politicians. He's on Twitter at RTManJR. That's Mann with two N's. Bob, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thank you, Ken. A pleasure.
4, 3, 2, 1. Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last independent or third-party presidential candidate to receive at least one electoral vote? The answer, John Hospers, the Libertarian Party's presidential nominee in 1972. Though he didn't come close to carrying a state, one so-called faithless elector from Virginia voted for Hospers, rather than the candidate who carried the Old Dominion, President Richard Nixon. And the randomly selected winner is Eleanor Tanner of Boston, Massachusetts. Eleanor wins the coveted political junkie button. And there's a new Scuttle Button puzzle up on our website. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Cokie Roberts died this week. She was 75 and had been suffering from breast cancer. Anyone who listened to her on NPR or watched her on ABC News was enriched by her knowledge, her compassion, her sense of humor, her ability to break down difficult topics into things we could all understand. She knew everybody, and everybody knew her. She was born in New Orleans, but grew up on Capitol Hill. Her father, Hale Boggs, was the powerful House Majority Leader in an institution at the time when Democrats were in complete control. For those who were privileged to know her personally, and I was among that lucky group, we got to see so much more. She touched everyone she met. When I was at ABC News, we had endless conversations about politics. When I was a casualty of the budget cutbacks at ABC in 1991, it was Cokie's idea that NPR create a position as political editor and that I fill it. We often had lunch together, and we often talked about her father, Hale Boggs, and how she never found peace because his body, lost in a plane crash in 1972, had never been recovered. She always called him Daddy. I still imagine Daddy walking into my kitchen and saying he's okay, she said to me. I can't begin to tell you how good she was to me for so many years and how much I cherished our friendship. After Boggs was presumed dead after that plane crash in Alaska, Cokie's mom, Lindy Boggs, won a special election to fill the House seat. She retired after 1990. When Lindy Boggs died in 2013, I had Cokie on an early episode of The Political Junkie to talk about her. Now, I should tell you that I spoke a little fast back then. I was still learning the ropes of hosting a show. I'm still learning. But Cokie was, well, vintage Cokie. Here's part of that interview. Cokie, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, nice to be with you, Ken. I'm missing my mother a lot.
She sounds like an unbelievable woman.
She was, but she was so much fun. You know, it all sounds so serious when you go through her list of accomplishments, which were in many and incredible. But she was also just always fun to be around, laughing and happy and good company.
And always charming. Apparently, she had no enemies. How is that possible?
Well, because she didn't cause people to become her enemy. She worked with people on both sides of the aisle. She would find a common cause with people, and she would make their lives easier by finding ways to work with them on things that they needed as she was asking them to do things that she needed. She also worked harder than anybody else, so they knew that she was in the trenches, and she was always kind and always funny.
There's a great anecdote I had read about her trying to attend a 1941 congressional hearing where Hale Boggs was about to give a speech, and then she told the guard she was a wife of the member of the banking committee, and he turned her away, something like that?
Because she was 24 years old, and he had called her and said, Linda, you have to come here to the Hill, because he had run with her very much as part of the campaign against war. This was 1940. And these were the Lend-Lease hearings, and he said, you're just never going to understand why we're getting into this if you don't come listen to these hearings. And so she went dashing to the Hill. She had two babies, neither of whom was me. Hmm. And she got there looking like a kid, and the guard just didn't believe her that she was the wife of a member of the committee. So she, as she told the story, she remembered that some fancy woman in New Orleans had told her before she went to Washington that the most sophisticated thing you could wear in that era was a purple veil. And so she went to a downtown department store and had a hat draped in a purple veil and put on her best suit and high heels and gloves and went back to the Capitol and said to the guard, would you seat me, please? I am Mrs. Hale Boggs. And he said, right this way, madam. And she joked that she looked at Washington through a purple veil ever since, and that was the name of her memoir.
She was not, I mean, there were a lot of congressional spouses, of course, but she was not just a regular congressional spouse.
Well, they were quite a group, actually, of indomitable congressional spouses, Lady Bird Johnson and Pauline Gore, and then later Betty Ford and others. And they were running everything. They ran their husbands' offices. They ran their campaigns. They basically ran the political conventions and voter registration drives. And it was before home rule here in Washington. And so they got together with the African-American women here and ran all the social service agencies. So they were quite a group.
Her husband, your dad, Hal Boggs, was a racial moderate in a region not known for racial moderation. Your mom, of course, was part of that legacy, and she continued that as a member of Congress. That must have been pretty difficult.
She was very clear about her view that racism had no place in American society. And she really felt that way from the beginning. It's somewhat remarkable because she was born on a plantation in Louisiana that could have just as easily been antebellum in the era that she was growing up. Because really of her religious views, always felt very, very strongly that all of us are created equal in the image and likeness of God, and that everyone has to be treated in that fashion. And so racism and classism and sexism had no place in her thinking.
What kind of a transition was there when she went from spouse to member of Congress?
Well, my sister teased her that the hardest thing she would have to do as a member of Congress was vote, because she always made everybody think that she was on their side. And she would go around after Daddy and say, oh, darling, you know, he had to vote that way because of X, Y, and Z, but, you know, he really feels this way. And so they always felt that she was with them. And my sister Barbara told her, Mom, you know, you're going to hate it. There's no maybe button. You have to vote yes or no. But she managed to do that and still, as you said earlier, keep people from becoming her enemy. It was in some ways a less powerful role, as odd as that seems. But being the wife of the majority leader, as my father was when he disappeared, versus being a freshman member of the House, she really sort of went down in status. But she still had the connections, of course, of being, having lived in Washington by that time for 30 years and making the many friends she had made. So, for instance, when she wanted to go on the banking committee as a freshman, and the committee was full, there was no room, she went to Speaker O'Neill and said, Tip, I need a seat on the banking committee. And he said, well, of course, darling. And that relationship was always very strong. Now, she wanted a seat on the banking committee because she had discovered, as many women did in that era, that not only did they lose their spouse to death or divorce, but at the same time they'd lose their credit, because women did not have credit in banking and in lending and borrowing. And so she wanted to go on the committee to fix that, and she did.
After she left Congress, she was President Clinton's ambassador at the Vatican. Apparently she shook things up there as well.
She did. She had a wonderful time at the Vatican, and she was very well loved. The cardinals loved being with her. She'd put little bottles of Tabasco in front of their places at dinner, and they'd always snitch them. But she understood the church, and she understood the politics, and she enjoyed them both. But she also came to understand, because Rome is really a center of non-governmental organizations, and they brought to her attention, some of them did, the terrible problems of human trafficking. And so she insisted that the church pay attention to that, that the United States government pay attention to that, and that the rest of the NGO community pay attention to that. And that was something that people didn't really expect from this nicey-nicey old lady, that she would be talking about sex slavery. But she did, and she made people keep an eye on it and try to improve the situation.
Every time I've read things about your mom, they always talked about she was the first woman to do this, the first woman
right,
to do that.
Right.
But she also just seemed like a remarkable, unbelievably remarkable woman.
She was. She was remarkable in so many ways. And at the end of her life, she died in July at age 97, she really did, even though she was slowing down, she really had a wonderful time, and she chose to be happy. And that is a great lesson for us all. It's a choice, and that's the choice she made.
Cokie, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts.
Nice to be with you, Ken.
That was my conversation with Cokie Roberts nearly 6 years ago, talking about the death of her mom, Lindy Boggs. Cokie died this week, on Tuesday, at age 75. There was no one like her, and we are all worse off without her.
Now it's time to say goodnight. Good night. Sleep tight. Now the sun.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Close your eyes. Sweet dreams.